Effervescent, that's our title today. When it comes to a man's labor under the sun, wisdom is found in the working moment when time meets opportunity and before the fool knows it has come. Definition in part of a fool, as we've seen throughout Ecclesiastes, that he does not know the times in which he lives. Now, as most of you know by now, when I prepare for preaching, I always try to distill the thrust of the text into one word. And I labor to do this. The word that best captures the message of Koheleth in this brace of parables is effervescent, which means ebullient, vivacious, bubbling, though of short duration. And once again, we have seen that rather than despair or vanity, right? Ecclesiastes is not inculcating that. It is indeed inculcating that time is brief, that life is brief, as it is in mist or vapor. Vapor is a better translation than vanity. We've seen this consistently throughout the book, okay? And how this describes wisdom, too. So full of life, but vaporous. Who can capture it, preserve it, save it for use in another day? Oh, if we could do that, if you could bottle wisdom, you'd make a fortune, wouldn't you? You cannot prepay for wisdom. You cannot pre-plan for wisdom. You cannot preempt the circumstances of life in order to be wise for them at some future date. No, wisdom is found in the particular moment when time meets opportunity. The point of being a fool in Solomon's mind is distilled here. The time and opportunity to act wisely is long gone before the fool even realizes it. Oh, I have an aging neighbor who sees that his end is near. Be in prayer for me as I work with him. I have a great opportunity for this friend of mine. He's giving to worthy causes now. He's helping local social groups, hoping that by the end of his labors, by the time he goes, his good works will outweigh and outnumber his bad works, right? And he's also looking for a church to join, as he says, so I can have a Christian burial. I've been sharing the gospel with him and getting to know him. So please be in prayer for me as I try and shepherd this aging neighbor of mine and just that the Lord would open his eyes. But so far he's trying to clean up the life of a fool. Koheleth delineates this principle in four tight, succinct parables. Everyone who works in the real world can comprehend these four tight, succinct parables. Number one, the passive circumstances of a man's everyday work conspire against the fool. Number one, the passive circumstances of a man's everyday work conspire against the fool. He who digs a pit will fall into it, and a serpent will bite him who breaks through the wall. He who quarries stones is hurt by them. He who splits logs is endangered by them, right? The natural fallen world is so full of pitfalls. The unprepared, unthoughtful man will perish by just bullying ahead through them. Even today, archaeologists digging beneath the foundation stones of Solomon's temple, for example, are impressed by the depth and stability of those stones. But the stones had to have a deep and solid pit in which to place those stones. The pit dug is a natural pitfall, if you will, and those who lean inward as it is dug fall into it. Also, the snake who inhabits the cool, dark nook in a wall. That's a common occurrence in the ancient world for a cold-blooded creature. That snake will bite the unsuspecting worker who's part of Solomon's urban renewal project. So they knew full well the circumstances here. A skidster also in an open pit is a danger, right, that one might fall into if not careful. The wise man will consider the natural barriers to his labors before he begins. Is he planning on digging a canal through Panama, maybe through swamps and forests filled with snakes and animals and malaria? We might even get that Panama Canal back if Donald Trump has his way, right? Are you planning on building an underground highway through Boston, infamously called the Big Dig? I've had a chance to travel through the Big Dig soon after a piece of concrete fell off on another motorist. And I kind of looked up with a bit of hesitancy as we went through. The wise foresees dangers and prepares, Proverbs says. The wise foresees danger and prepares. The simple keep going and pay for it. Secondly, the active circumstances of a man's everyday work conspire against the fool as well. The idea of everyday labor, wisdom is found and bubbles up and is made evident in a man's everyday labor. In parallel lines, the forward actions of the working man also present potential dangers if he's not careful. In Solomon's work gangs, quarrying the marble for the temple, if a foreman had his men work from top to bottom on a large piece of stone, then squash, it would fall outward from its place, from the cliff, and crush those below. But if the foreman and his workmen worked from the bottom to the top, cutting the stone, they would be above it when it fell to the ground below. One approach was wise, one was foolish. Also, if you lean into the log splitting machine, well, wait a minute, Solomon didn't have a craftsman's log splitter in those days, did he? No. If you lean into the axe as it splits the log, you're in danger of being hit by flying pieces. Even our Lord employed wise builders in his parables. Build on a rock rather than sand in Matthew chapter 7, and plan ahead with adequate resources if you expect to finish. Thirdly, a sharp axe is more efficient than a dull one. This seems obvious on its face, doesn't it? While this may seem transparently simple, have you ever stopped work cutting in order to sharpen your axe or your chainsaw? Sometimes we just stubbornly move on through, don't we? Bothersome, isn't it, to have to stop and sharpen that chainsaw again, right? Every spring and fall, I have to take my chainsaw, cut down a whole bunch of dead wood that's accumulated, and I found that principle to be also true. 10 minutes of sharpening my chainsaw is worth an hour of cutting with a dull blade. Man is distinguished from brute animals because he employs tools to accomplish his work. Where would we be without them? The fool ignores, mistreats, and misuses them, doesn't he? So, note to self, get a new chain, right, for my chainsaw. Number four, if the end of your labor is lost before you begin, why continue it? The snake charmer. What a poignant figure we have here before us in the snake charmer, bitten before he begins to toot his pipe, right? Jim is also fond of pointing out there are bits of humor throughout the scripture. Scripture is not without a sense of humor, and so we have one here. If the snake charmer, right, the pro, gets bitten before he even begins his music, what good is he? What good is his seance? I'd want my money back before the snake charmer checks out from his snake bite. Some of you may remember a deacon from long ago. He was a programmer out at INL. He worked for 11 years on two projects. And he once told me, Pastor, I can take you to a shelf in the warehouse and show you both of these projects out at INL. And both were unfinished, 20 years of work. He says, I worked for 11 years on two projects that never reached completion since we ran out of funding eventually for both of them. They wanted to hire me for a third project, but I wanted to actually accomplish something before I died, he said. So he knew the end of his labor would be lost before he even began on this third project if he undertook it, so why even start? Instead, he joined a team and struck out on an entrepreneurial adventure. The Great American Dream is doing so much better, much happier too. Well, one of Kohelet's major motifs is precisely this. A man's labor is valuable and worthwhile. One of the number of pursuits in life worth doing, right? Despite its fleeting reward and endurance under the sun. Not vain, not hopeless, not empty, but brief, vaporous. We're wired for labor, for productive work. We were created to be gardeners par excellence in the first place. And in the restored kingdom, we will be laboring again, this time with the curse lifted. Solomon has been pushing us towards this throughout his treatise. You know he has, right? I've been pointing this out with you chapter after chapter after chapter. And he's growing and expanding in the scope of his view of our worthy labor, hinting that there is a world under the sun, but another above the sun, too, in which wisdom will be the gift bestowed on every man. Then the sweat of our brow will water a flourishing creation, blessed, not cursed, by the Maker. What a day that will be. What a fulfilling, glorious age that will be. In the meantime, we signal the world to come in this one. We do signal the world to come in this world, in this life. This very worship service is a signal of the world to come, a taste, if you will, of heavenly blessing to come. Are you wise? If so, it will be made evident in the working moment when time meets opportunity, and you'll know it, and you'll experience it, and you'll reflect it to the glory of God. You will be wise, productive, and conscientious. You cannot expect do-overs and second chances and reverse mode as an app to reality, can you? The mark of wisdom is to read the present aright, a great proverb says. The mark of wisdom is to read the present aright. Your day and time is vaporous, fleeting, and effervescent, that is vivacious and bubbling, though of short duration. How are you employing it to your labor under the sun? That brings us to point two, effervescent, verses 12 through 15. When it comes to a man's speech, under the sun, wisdom is found in the spoken moment when time meets opportunity before the fool even knows it has come. We have euphemisms that capture this sense of the wise and the fool. You know, you look back at the day and you said, if I'd only said dot, 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 right? When we think of that perfect response 2 days later to the insult, the question, the perfect riposte in every debate, right? Or if I could only take back those words, right? Don't you wish you could have done that, right? How many circumstances? If I only hadn't said that, if I could only just take back those words. As a Dutch proverb, my Dutch grandmother used to promulgate, how the wise speak slowly and not often. How the wise speak slowly and not often. And how the wisdom literature is dense with advice about speech, isn't it? That we speak, that we employ language, that we are creatures of the word, distinguishes us from the animals. We are sentient creatures in this sense. Most importantly, that we are creatures made in the Imago Dei, the image of God. Question 10 of our shorter catechism says, how did God create man? God created man, male and female, after his own image, in knowledge, righteousness, and holiness, with dominion over the creatures. Christ is now restoring us in knowledge, righteousness and holiness, and thus restoring the image of God in us through Christ. Or as Proverbs says, Proverbs 17:28, even the fool is deemed wise when he keeps silent, right? Like the Dutch proverb, how the wise speak slowly and not often. Proverbs 10:21, the lips of the righteous are nourishment to many. I like that translation. The lips of the righteous are nourishment to many. Don't you walk away from some people who are wise and gracious, feeling like your spirit has been nourished by their speech, by how they have communicated with you. Well, here Koheleth captures the fleeting moment in which we discover ourselves and our fellow men to be either wise or fool. First, a man's speech can nourish or destroy his lot in life. The words of a wise man's mouth wins him favor, but the lips of a fool consume him. Number two, the fool's speech digresses from foolishness to inevitable wicked madness. The beginning of the words of his mouth is foolishness, and the end of his talk is evil madness. I found in life, I've shared this with many of you, that you become more of what you are as you age. You become more of what you are as you age. As age indeed peels away your faculties, your defenses, and then indeed people begin to see the true man underneath, right? This proverb captures that principle. King Nebuchadnezzar, in his foolish descent into madness, finally uttered Adam's inspiration at the garden, inspired by the serpent, from Daniel chapter 4. All this came upon King Nebuchadnezzar. At the end of 12 months, he was walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon, and the king answered and said, "Is not this great Babylon, which I have built by my mighty power as a royal residence, for the glory of my majesty?" And while the words were still in the king's mouth, there fell a voice from heaven, "O King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken. The kingdom has departed from you, and you shall be driven from among men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. And you shall be made to eat grass like an ox, and 7 periods of time shall pass over you until you know that the Most High rules the kingdoms of men and gives them to whom he will." Immediately, the word was fulfilled against Nebuchadnezzar. He was driven from among men and ate grass like an ox, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, till his hair grew as long as eagle's feathers, and his nails were like bird's claws. The fool's speech. In the New Testament, we see the same foolishness that leads to madness in the lives of men like Simon Magus, who, as Luke tells us in Acts, had practiced magic, saying he himself was somebody great, or Diotrephes in John's letters, who likes to put himself first, talking wicked nonsense against us, John says. So it is with the fool. In the book Helter Skelter, Charles Manson's descent into wicked, murderous madness is chronicled, and it's chilling too. He had the gift of gab. He could talk. He could persuade. He could talk young girls into murder. Karl Marx is said to have descended into blathering madness in his latter days, as well as Adolf Hitler in his last days in his bunker before he took his own life. Speech. Speech reveals who we are so often, doesn't it? Number three, saying it doesn't necessarily make it so. The fool multiplies words, though no man knows what's to be, and who can tell what will come after him. Just saying it doesn't make it so. It's another persistent motif in Ecclesiastes. As he says in chapter 1, though what has been will be, and what is now has been before, no man can discern when what has been will come around again, and when what is now will crop up in history or a man's particular life again. Right? James cautions us in this. He says, come now, you who say today or tomorrow we'll go into such and such a town and spend a year there and trade and make a profit. We may go into Salt Lake City for a week, right, and trade and make a profit. Yet you do not know what tomorrow will bring. What is your life? For you are just a mist that appears for a little time and then vanishes. See, there's that theme again of the vaporousness of life. Not its vanity, not its absurdity, but its brevity, its vaporousness. Your life is but a vapor. It appears for a little time and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, and I'm sure that Amber is saying this, if the Lord wills, we will live and do this or that and travel to Salt Lake City on business, right? James goes on to say, as it is, you boast in your arrogance. I'm sure Amber is not boasting in her arrogance, no. All such boasting is evil. So whoever knows the right thing to do and fails to do it, for him it is sin. The toil of a fool wearies him, for he does not know the way to the city. Ecclesiastes says, the toil of a fool has loquacious verbosity. The idea is that he's so busy speaking on the way that he does not have the common sense to ask for directions to the city. That's the way of the fool. So cocksure of his own wisdom and direction that he does not have to bother with the wisdom and direction of another, especially Solomon. Now this will be the fate of Rehoboam and his sons after him, despite this wisdom tract. Remember, the purpose for this wisdom tract for Ecclesiastes is to be a training tool for his sons to rule wisely. We've all known such men. Perhaps we've been such men in the past. Listen to the counsel of those wiser than you, especially those of you who are young. Take the directions of wisdom. It is more precious than gold, more precious than silver or precious stones. Wise speech cannot be stored up for future use. Wisdom is found in the spoken moment. It is a gift of God, tracked and trailed and acquired through much study and acquisition in God's word and in prayer and in consultation with those who are wise. And that brings us to point three, effervescent or vaporous. Effervescent. Verses 16 through 20. When it comes to a man's allegiance under the sun, wisdom is found in the serving moment when time meets opportunity before the fool knows it has come. If Rehoboam had bothered to read and heed the profound wisdom tract here, he might have taken a different course than the foolish one he followed. You remember he followed the advice of the young bucks in the palace, full of themselves in pride and arrogance instead of the humility of the older ones, right? Had the king been a servant rather than a tyrant, his allegiance to the God of his father, what would have been the kingdom, huh? Wisdom is found in the serving moment as well, when time meets opportunity, before the fool, like Rehoboam, even knows it's come. It's come and gone before the fool even is aware of it. What might have been had he listened to these words? Huh? First of all, there is a season for all things under the sun. Now here Koheleth reprises the theme of chapter 3, using the feast as an example. Is feasting just plain old gluttony? Is drinking wine wicked and automatically drunkenness? Should we all just eat bread and water like monks? Absolutely not. Wisdom comes in knowing the apt time for feasting and drinking wine. When the king is a young upstart like Rehoboam, partying with his young posse, listening to their advice, acting accordingly, then it is an inapt time for feasting and drinking, and the people exclaim, "Woe to you, O land of Israel!" But when the prince feasts at the proper time, as when Solomon greeted and entertained the Queen of Sheba, then it is an apt time for feasting and drinking. What was the bottom line for Solomon and Israel and the glory of God? Well, the Queen of Sheba said, "The report was true that I heard in my own land of your words and your wisdom, but I did not believe the report until I came, and my own eyes have seen it. And behold, the half was not told me. Your wisdom and prosperity surpass the report that I heard. Happy are your men. Happy are your servants who continually stand before you and hear your wisdom. Blessed be the Lord your God who has delighted in you and set you on the throne of Israel. Because the Lord loved Israel forever, he has made you king, that you may execute justice and righteousness." Well, secondly, a wise king is a man of industry. A wise king is a man of industry. Through sloth, the roof sinks in, and through indolence, the house leaks, right? Solomon, the builder of the Temple of David, could only dream of constructing. He knows this homely proverb to his toenails, doesn't he? Through sloth, the roof sinks in, and through indolence, the house leaks, right? If you've ever owned a home, you know this truth. What would happen to Israel had Solomon's sons listened to their father? As it happens in Kings and in Chronicles, we see the house, both literal, the temple, and the figurative house, that is David's line. We see them both decay and collapse. That's a motif we don't always point out, but we should through Kings and Chronicles, that there are two tracks, just as Nathan exclaims to David, "You want to build me a house, that is a temple, I'm going to build you a house, that is a house of lineage," right? And Kings and Chronicles both track with both the physical temple and the figurative temple as they both decay and collapse throughout the book of Kings. What would have happened, indeed, had Rehoboam followed the wisdom of his fathers? The temple is desecrated time and again. The gold is plundered and replaced with brass, stuffed with idols, and it's finally destroyed. David's son becomes worse and worse, sinking further and further into wickedness and decay until they're blinded and dragged into captivity into Assyria and Babylon. Had it not been to the promise of God to David, that house would have disappeared into obscurity. But it was not, did not, did it eventually. The respective decay is parallel. Both houses collapse at the same rate and are eventually destroyed. And then, thirdly, it's the economy, stupid, right? A wise king does all within his power to bring prosperity to his people. In the war room of the Clinton campaign headquarters, back in 1992, that was, yeah, 1992, James Carville had posted this now famous sign: "It's the economy, stupid." That is, the election would hang upon what the president could do to prosper and flourish the American economy. The people, in the last analysis, voted on pocketbook issues. Foreign policy, social issues, personal character, as important as they might be, took a backseat to how well the people did economically. And this laser-like focus brought him two terms. In fact, Donald Trump focused on this as well, in large part, and won this time around as well. Well, Solomon would have agreed with him. It's the economy, and we're not stupid, right? And number four, everyone has tells showing how they feel about the king, right? "Even in your thoughts, do not curse the king, nor in your bedroom curse the rich, For a bird of the air will carry your voice, or some winged creature tell the matter. A very picturesque way of describing how human beings have tells about what they're thinking and feeling. A wise king knows how to read people. You don't get very far unless you are able to do so. Their eyes, their countenance, the tone of voice, body language. Anyone who lives by their wits, kings preeminently, knows how to do these things intuitively. Gamblers develop a poker face, knowing other gamblers read the tiny signals communicated as to whether a hand is good or bad. Con men learn to read a victim's expressions and body language to know when, where, and how a victim can be hustled, right? A tell is a gesture, an expression, body language that tell, if you will, when a potential victim is ready for the close. Counselors learn to read a client's facial expressions and body language to tell when they're being truthful or lying. A wise king does this too. The truth will out. That bird, that winged creature, is in fact the very things you least suspect. Your own eyes, your own furrowed brow, your fidgety foot, your flickering upper lip, your tense hand, your labored breathing. These all fly from you to the eyes, the ears, and the intuition of his king and the advisors. Israeli airline, El Al Israel, their security is skilled in this art. They are on the alert for potential dangers and terror in the skies from passengers with ill intent. When you approach El Al Airlines, far from the terminal, your car is searched and you are questioned, and you are rated on a scale from 1 to 6. That rating can change with different interviews, but that first interviewer puts on your passport a number which rates you on a scale from 1 to 6. Even before entering the terminal, your baggage is checked and you are questioned again. And then before boarding, you're searched and questioned again. And you might be pulled aside at any moment for a thorough, intensive questioning. Security is skilled at these things. They're trained in reading cues, facial, body, verbal, personal cues. Very intuitive it is. El Al Israel has been operating for 75 years. They've only had one hijacking in all that time. And they've been targets, heavy-duty targets of terror and all of this, but they've only had one hijacking with no fatalities, for that matter. The article from which I took this, Business Insider, said, "Too bad the TSA has yet to find a workable system of their own." The upshot is, be prepared to serve in good conscience and goodwill, whether you are a king or a subject. Solomon would expect this from his princely sons, but he would not get it. Instead, the house would sink and leak and decay. But it would take another son of David who would serve. Indeed, God's promises through Nathan to David were made good in this son. We read a portion of his heart of service today from Mark chapter 10, whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be slave of all. Even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. So, brother and sister, let us be like master, like servant, like teacher, like student. May you serve. May you be first in the kingdom because you were willing to be last of all. Let us now come to that place then where we find a rich feast of grace. Apt time for this, where we find a rich feast of grace in the simple elements of the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.